Welcome to another episode of Foretaste of the Feast, a podcast of Calvary Lutheran Church. I'm Director of Faith Formation Kyle Jones, and I'm joined not by our senior pastor Ken Nelson, as he's away, but by our pastoral intern Ben Blobaum, and we're continuing on in our small catechism series with the Ten Commandments, Commandments 4, 5, 6, and 7, which is a lot to cover, but I think we'll be able to do it well. And so we're just going to jump right into the fourth commandment here, honor your father and mother. What does this mean? We should fear and love God so that we do not despise or anger our parents and other authorities, but honor them, serve and obey them, love and cherish them. There's a lot going on here. What's so significant about this fourth commandment?
I maybe just by way of review, just to, you know, how did we get here to these other commandments? I think we talked about last time, you know, Luther sees the first commandment in all the rest of the nine, because each of his explanations begins, what does this mean? We should fear and love God
so that.
And so, in other words, all of the rest of these commandments that we're dealing with are concretely how we keep the first commandment. If above all things we are to love God with our whole being, how do we actually do that? What does it mean to love God? It means we don't misuse his name. We keep the Sabbath holy. We honor our mother and father. We don't kill, and so on and so forth. And so, So, just by way of review to try to get into these, you know, the commandments that we're dealing with today, the commandments we'll deal with next time, all of these are concretely how we remain faithful to the first commandment and love God with all our heart and not have any other gods, is by being obedient to these commandments. I do think it's significant, while this isn't a term we find in the Bible, the church and theologians have tended to split the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments into so-called two tables. And so with today's episode, we're moving into the second table. The reason they make that delineation or the distinction is, you know, they typically say that the first three commandments pertain explicitly to our vertical relationship with God. You shall not have other gods. Don't misuse the name of God. Honor the day that he has set aside. And now we move into commandments that concern explicitly our care and concern for our neighbor, our relationships with our neighbor. And so, right, as you quoted at the beginning of this, the first commandment that we find in the second table relates to our relationships with our parents. And so I do think it's significant that both of the so-called tables of the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments concern our most primal relationships, our relationship with our Heavenly Father and our relationship with our earthly parents. And we are who we are. Each person is who he or she is on account of these relationships. We receive our identity from God and from our earthly parents. Personal identity, in other words, is inextricably linked and derived from these most fundamental relationships that we have.
Yeah, Luther in the Large Catechism makes a big deal of the fourth commandment. It's one, in the past, what I've used to teach or help students think about the role of the fourth commandment, even within the commandments, is almost kind of like the hinge between the two tables. And that's the point that Luther hammers again and again in the Large Catechism, is that of all the roles, of all of the vocations, of all of the callings that God has given and gifted, the role of father and mother has, Luther calls it, as like a right-hand place, a right next to him, to God, because, as Luther tried, with the whole point of the catechisms in general, is that parents speak God's grace and forgiveness to their children. Children learn who God is, positively or negatively, from their parents. Luther doesn't say that the clergy or the Pope or the pastors or him or the other reformers hold this kind of role, but it's parents and other authorities who are tasked and gifted with teaching God's word. And so that's why Luther places such a big deal on them. But also it comes from the wording itself that's used in the commandment, honor your father and mother. In the Large Catechism, Luther points out that we're called to honor them, which includes love and beyond, which plays a big role in what Luther has to say through his explanation here in the Small Catechism and so on. And so it's a big hinge, because what we're doing is moving from that first table, but we're not really leaving it behind, as you pointed out. We're still stuck with the first commandment there, but we're also seeing our relationship to the people who represent God first to us in our life and who act as God, reflect God's action. God creates out of nothing, and while parents don't create out of nothing, they do bring life into the world through God's design and the way that he works. And so parents automatically from the beginning of a child's life are playing the role that God has called for them in reflecting how God interacts in the world as well.
Yeah, you brought up child rearing, and this commandment, I think, is internal to the very order of creation itself. The very first commandment that God gives to Adam and Eve after he creates them is be fruitful and multiply. In other words, he commands Adam and Eve to engage in sexual intercourse and have children, to set up the household. And I mean, we should note that the command was not given to single persons. The command was given to Adam and Eve, who were married. The command was given to a married man and woman, to a husband and wife. And so, thus, marriage in the household is the very first human institution that God creates. And this commandment, you know, there's a universality to it then also, because it is internal to the very structure and order of creation itself, regardless of whatever the familial arrangement is in which one is actually raised, and there are quite a plethora of arrangements today, but regardless of the arrangement that one is actually raised in, nevertheless, it's a biological fact of reality that every single human person has a mother and a father. It is the way that God has ordained and designed human creatures. And so this commandment is intrinsically related to the structure of the creation itself.
Yeah, and that brings us to an interesting thing that's kind of that comes out in the Small Catechism, but in one sense starts here in the Fourth Commandment. And that's this idea that Luther is working with that doesn't get talked about a whole lot, kind of gets overshadowed by another kind of way of viewing the world and God's interaction in it and our place in it, called the three estates, where you kind of have these three areas almost that are not separate from each other, but we could think about them as distinct. And within them, there are certain kind of callings that work in different ways. And we all live in all three of them. And they're the church, the home, and
the civil government, civil order.
Yeah. And politics or the government, however you want. But when Luther is talking about the three estates and in the places that he does, the home or the family, which includes for him the economy, because he's living in a time where people are, if they have a business, it's like out of their home or they're farmers, or there's not necessarily like tons and tons of like, I leave my home and go to my business, or in the world we live in now where we work, most people work jobs for other people. Luther counts the economy kind of within that estate of the home. That's like the, as you pointed out, that's the first one, but it's also the most foundational. And it's the place where the church and the estate of the church and the estate of the government or politics, whatever term you want to use, kind of come and collide together in one place. And Luther's goal with the Small Catechism, one of the things that he does with it is move I think Jim Nestikin puts it this way. He moves the altar from the church, from the village church, into the whole, every person's home where God is active and living. Abraham didn't have like a church, but God called him to go and be, and Abraham makes sacrifices, and Jacob was the same. There was no temple, there was no tabernacle. And even when you read through 1st and 2nd Samuel, it's kind of unclear as to exactly where the tabernacle and all the Ark of the Covenant and the various pieces of worship equipment are. God is still within the midst of the family there. And so it's not, it's the family that brings itself to church. It's the family that interacts in the government, or in the case of the way that government works in America, where the government is populated by people who are part of families who are taking care of other families. And that's the whole point of a government, is to help protect and keep society in order to keep families and people safe within it.
Yeah, even in his explanation in the Small Catechism of this commandment, Luther includes this phrase, and other authorities. And so right there, you know, Luther understands this commandment to include those authorities of church and state. Mm-hmm. You know, that would even include things like teachers, preachers, mm-hmm. The magistrates, and so on and so forth. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah, the other thing, whenever you teach this to students, they're like, they get it on a cognitive level, and they're like, yeah, sure. Things are usually easier when I obey my parents. But the question always comes up, well, what if? It's the great confirmation question, as opposed to what does this mean, but rather what if? And those are perfectly logical and perfect questions to ask, because we should be, especially with that at the middle school age. That's how they are exploring the world and testing the boundaries to see if the things that they are learning, how they apply, since they're learning about gray area all of a sudden. But what if my parents are not good parents? Do I have to obey and honor them then? And Luther, as we would also attest to, says, well, yes, even if they are bad parents or bad authorities, we should honor them because God has put them in this place. And that gets difficult, because then, of course, whenever you're talking about rulers and leaders, you're like, well, what about Hitler? He's the prime example of a bad leader that you shouldn't obey and listen to. And there's one sense where you shouldn't obey and listen. But how do you honor that kind of position? And we won't delve into the complicated, nuanced nature of that kind of question, because it's just outside of the scope and time we have for this episode.
Yeah.
But it's always a difficult thing to kind of tread through with students, because a lot of times it'll hit home directly for them, or they'll have a friend who's, they only have one parent in their life because the other parent is gone and has either not put forth any effort to be in their life or have a relationship with them. So what are they supposed to do by not trying to call their parent that doesn't reach out to them? Are they like not honoring them? Are they breaking this commandment in what way? And it's hard, but implicit within this commandment, which Luther draws out in the Large Catechism, is that parents and authorities are also called to be good parents and good rulers. And Luther goes into details what that means, in that if he's placed parents and authorities in a place that they reflect him, what is God doing, which we haven't technically gotten to in the creed, because we haven't got to the creed yet. But God is doing everything to provide for those who are in need. And in the first article of the creed, Luther will talk about all of the physical and material gifts that God gives us. So parents and authorities should be doing that, not ruling and parenting for selfish gain or advancement or at the disadvantage of their children / neighbors. So there's a lot still even more going on in here, because we have that negative positive spin here. So that we do not despise or anger our parents and other authorities, but honor, serve, and obey them, love, and cherish them. The other thing that I just noticed, I've read this catechism so many times, and I somehow, every time I read it, there's always a little bit of something going on here. That term, serve and obey, will come up again in Luther's explanation of the first article of the creed, where at the end of that article, he'll say gives us all these things, protects us from evil, out of Father, Lady, divine goodness and mercy, without any merit or worthiness in me, so that I may thank, praise, serve, and obey him. And so you kind of see this reflection of what Luther is teaching us about what the fourth commandment is calling us to do, and that's to serve and obey our parents because they are reflections of God's grace and mercy. Well, they should be reflections of God's grace and mercy in our life, and hopefully your parents are/were.
Yeah.
Dear listener.
Yeah, that's a good observation, that connection with Luther's explanation of the first article of the Creed, that in a sense, you know, certainly our earthly fathers, but, you know, our earthly fathers and mothers also are, in a sense, metaphorical representation of our Heavenly Father. And part of the way that we learn to fear, love, trust, and obey God is by loving, serving, and obeying our earthly parents.
Let's piggyback on that a little bit, because this is the one thing that Luther will hit again and again in the Large Catechism, and it's hard to not refer to Luther's Large Catechism sometimes, and that's just an aside. It's worth reading, especially of all the things he talks about. He spends the most time talking about the commandments themselves, showing again that the commandments are not just something to leave behind simply because you've been baptized and have communion and receive forgiveness of sins each and every week. But he'll spend time again and again talking about how God has given us enough to do. We don't have to make up our own works. And for children, you don't have to guess what God wants from you. Here it is, right then and there. Like, this is enough to do for a lifetime. Don't try to keep going and find other things to make God happy or to live out the way that God has created the world. And I think that's the important note right then and right there, is that this is within your everyday life. It's not some extra special thing. And that's what Luther is constantly pushing back against implicitly in the Small Catechism, explicitly in the Large Catechism and in his other writings, is that God doesn't call us to separate ourselves from the world or to love God in a manner in which we have no contact with our neighbor, but within the midst of the relationships we have with our neighbor. And use that term concrete earlier when we were introducing this fourth commandment and tying it back to where Luther has this in the first commandment. This is a very concrete everyday reality for people. Whether you or your parents are still alive and you have a relationship with them, or you are a parent yourself, or also the other authorities in which we interact with, whether it's a boss or government officials and whatnot. This is a very concrete commandment to start with. And as we'll see as we go throughout these, it gets almost more and more concrete in its effects and the things that we need to guard against and protect here. And that's the role of one of the roles of the fourth commandment, is to show us, or the commandments in general, rather, is to show us not just how to live in relationship with God by faith, but how our relationship with God affects our relationship with our neighbors specifically. And if we don't have that relationship with God, then there's a better chance of harming our neighbors than with. Not that that's a guarantee.
I guess the only other thing occurs to me to add is part of what is utterly distinct and unique about the relationships described in this commandment is none of them were the outcome of our choices. Mm-hmm. God chose these relationships for us. God chose who would be our mommy and our daddy. God gives to parents the children that they have. So there's a givenness mm-hmm. To the relationships that are protected under this commandment. And it may be why, I mean, the family is becoming kind of a scandal in our culture today, where, you know, increasingly We want to have no obligation or relations that were not of our choosing. Mm-hmm. But right here at the head of the second table of the commandments, our relationships that were the outcome, sheerly the outcome of God's mm-hmm. choosing. God put us in these relationships. They were God-ordained, we might mm-hmm. say.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we see, you know, just how sacred and beautiful marriage and the household is to God.
Yeah. And one more thing that we could say in wrapping this up is we spent almost half the episode already talking about, it's a very important commandment. And the rest, I think, will come out of that because it's really the first place that we can see these things, the fifth, sixth, and seventh commandment play out is in the home mm-hmm. And the homes of those next to us and whatnot. And so we'll talk about those, but it's this other doctrinal point of view that has been considered, I think, perhaps maybe the most revolutionary of the Reformation. And that is this idea of vocation, where God has given his grace and mercy to people and given them gifts in specific roles and those roles change and morph a little over time, but parent is one of them. Student, teacher, child, spouse, sibling, grandparent, uncle, aunt, church worker, office worker, police officer, you know, pick a job, but we mean vocation in a much bigger way here. And it's through these vocations in these specific roles, that God has gifted and given and placed us in within these three estates in which God is working in the small things and the little things each and every day. We would use this term like that parents are masks of God, and if they recognize that, then they are much better off in bestowing forgiveness and grace to their children when they need it the most, which is what God has anchored our relationship with him in, is in the forgiveness of sins freely given to us in Christ. And so let's move then to the fifth commandment. That fifth commandment, which most people know, and again, another one of those, a lot of gray area caveat type questions that come up with this one when you're speaking about it with students, but even with adults. You shall not murder. What does this mean? Or what is this? We should fear and love God so that we do not harm or hurt our neighbor in his body, but help and support him in every physical need. So the fifth commandment there, whereas the fourth commandment was given, we received the gift of parents and authorities and family in the fourth commandment. It's also given to protect the family, but also to protect the relationship between parents and children, and vice versa. This one is given to protect our bodies. And God is giving the gift of life in the commandments in this way. When we talk about all the things that are going on in this commandment itself.
Yeah, this may sound common sense or just, you know, even foolish to say, but nevertheless, might be worth saying that this commandment pertains explicitly to human beings. Mm-hmm. you know, at least after the flood in the Noahide covenant, God, in his instructions to Noah and his progeny, gives the animals to humanity for food. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, it was just the vegetation. But so we're not breaking the fourth commandment when we, you know, kill the chickens on the farm to have for meat, or the cows or the pigs or whatever. So again, it might seem reductionistic or just like stating the obvious, mm-hmm. To say, but it does pertain to, our relations with other human creatures.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's an interesting parallel moving through here. So we brought up Adam and Eve in the fourth commandment and in one sense, the first family. Well, what's the first thing that goes wrong outside after the fall that we're told about? And that is Cain and Abel and Cain murdering his brother. So, I mean, we could see that all the way in Exodus, God is kind of reflecting back through the stories of the histories of the people he has created. And already say, all right, we have a family. And what's the first thing that goes wrong in a family that might need to be put out? And it's not what we'll talk about in the Sixth Commandment, but that family members shouldn't kill family members.
Yeah.
People that God created shouldn't kill people that God created.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, the Fifth Commandment extends beyond simply just life itself, but also extends to quality of life. I mean, Luther's explanation here, he says, so that we do not hurt or harm our neighbor in his body, but help and support him in every physical need, meaning like you shouldn't let your neighbor's livelihood disappear. You shouldn't let your neighbor get beat up. And that's, you know, that, I mean, the silly, I don't know if it's silly, but the example that always springs to my brain is all those anti-bullying videos that they make you watch in school, where you should stand up for somebody else. And those videos are always a little silly and trite when you're in high school. But at the same time, that's what God is also calling us to do in each and every way, to help those who are the victims of injustice stop experiencing that injustice. And that's not always easy to do in the world that we live in. And it's complicated and it's big and nuanced. And how do we do that? And but of course, the first place that it starts is by thinking little and small. And that's like the person, one, the people within your own family unit, and then the people who you come into contact with every day.
Yeah, it's a remarkable point that you know, you bring up in Luther's explanation. And you're right, it is difficult not to refer back to the, you know, the larger explanations in the large commandment or the large catechism, but it is remarkable what Luther does with this commandment in particular. You know, he says that we break this commandment not only by our acts of commission, but also by our omission, that if we see our neighbor in danger, his life in danger, his life being threatened, and we have the means and opportunity to do something about it, to prevent our neighbor's death, but we refuse or neglect to help him when we see him in need, we have killed him. We're guilty of breaking the Fifth Commandment. You know, just to tie this into a parable, we see that in the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, sure, it's the robbers who jump out from behind the rock, who by their act of commission beat up the man and leave him for dead. But the priest and the Levite who come walking by see their neighbor in need, see his life in jeopardy, and by continuing to pass on, this is the commandment that they've broken. You know, at first glance in that parable, I think it appears as if it's the robbers who have committed the worst offense. But based on Luther's explanation, what he's saying here, that we kill our neighbor when we refuse or neglect to help them when they're in need, no, the priest and the Levite broke the same commandment that the robbers did. They are all guilty of the same offense. It is a pretty profound point that he makes in his explanation here.
Yeah, well, in the Large Catechism, we put it this way: from wherever murder is forbidden, all causes from which murder may spring is also forbidden. So whether it's neglect, or in the case of the parable of the Good Samaritan, the religious rules of the Pharisee and Levite, like both of those things are forbidden by this commandment here. And yeah, Luther does a great job of drilling down on what Jesus already says in the table, in the Sermon on the Mount, where he doesn't set aside the commandments, but instead makes them even more impossible to follow and to keep, where he who is angry with his brother has murdered him in his heart. And Luther is drawing from that, knowing how quickly it goes from one to the other. I mean, if you go back and read the story of Cain and Abel, it's seems fairly innocuous in the way that it's written anyway. You know, and Cain was kind of pissed that God regarded Abel over him. But who is Cain mad at? God, really, but who gets killed? Abel. So because of Cain not being having the quote unquote power to control his situation, because he's up against God and angry with God, takes it out on his neighbor, his brother, and you know, and now we're here.
Yeah.
Also, not implicit in this commandment, kind of. I think it's a little bit more explicit, but it's worth stating out loud, is the importance placed on the physical nature and the physical body of life. I think sometimes within the religious world or in the church, there's such an emphasis on spirituality and the spiritual and the soul, and those are good and important emphases. But God has not like left those behind or taken left the body behind. Like, we are not just souls in a meat suit waiting to be reunited with some other spiritual presence or to float around like Casper the Friendly Ghost. In a better place than this, we believe in the resurrection of the body. And so God has placed an important emphasis here already in the fifth commandment on the body itself.
If there are any Gnostics listening, you've just upset every single one of them.
I'm all right with that. Well, let's move over to the sixth commandment. This is always the commandment that's the most nerve-wracking for new time confirmation teachers. It's the sex one. It's a little bit more than that, and I think that we'll be able to bring more nuance to this. But the sixth commandment says, you shall not commit adultery. What does this mean? We should fear and love God so that we lead sexually pure and decent, a sexually pure and decent life in what we say and do, and husband and wife love and honor each other. Point of emphasis here, this is the only commandment outside of the first one to have only a positive construction. There is no don't do this, but do that. It just says do this, just do this. And sometimes it seems confirmation instruction in the, for students on this commandment gets hung up oftentimes on the definition of what sex is here, because you never know how many students have already had, what education they've already had. But really what this is doing is protecting the backbone of the family, which is the marriage, but also one of the most important unifying aspects of a marriage, and that is sex. And that what this commandment is especially wanting us to pay attention to is that people are your spouse, especially, and people in general, are not simply made for your gratification, sexual or otherwise. Now, this commandment particularly pertains to sex, but we can certainly, when we talk about things like lust, and what we're doing there is using people and objectifying them in order so that they can become a part of our happiness. And then that's where the relationship ends. And so the relationship between husband and wife, God says, should not be based upon the non-mutual, I guess would be the way to say it, non-mutual benefit of others. So don't use your spouse simply to make yourself happy, but honor and love your spouse. And Paul will go on in, I forget, Ephesians, and Peter, I think, will go and say some of the same stuff where husband and wife love and honor each other in slightly different ways. But what they're really doing is the husband is reflecting Christ and the wife is reflecting the church. And the husband is supposed to give his life up for his wife, which is not always an easy thing to do in the world that we live in or in the state of the world in which we live. So there's a lot going on here, but sometimes I think we just get lost in the, it says sex, so we have to talk about all of the things that that includes. Well, like, let's talk about like what God is really getting to here first and foremost, because then otherwise everything else gets lost in the mix.
It should get our attention. First of all, I think that there are not one, but two commandments in the Decalogue explicitly concerned with marriage and the household. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is, you're right, you know, as you were pointing out, the marital relationship between husband and wife is an image and representation of Christ's relationship with his bride, the church. And so there is an aspect to marital infidelity that by its own nature preaches a false gospel. Not explicitly, but because it is an image and representation of the oneness of Christ and his church, it does communicate a falsehood to the world. For one thing, I think, you know, where Christian marriages are concerned, it can cast doubt or pose the question to the world, well, look, can God not even hold, you know, these marriages together? It is a really sacred relationship. And, you know, in his explanation, Luther, well, it's clear he addresses adultery, understands adultery as being not just in the physical act we commit, but also in what we say. Mm-hmm. What's the, could you read the language in his explanation again?
Yeah. We should fear and love God so that we lead a sexually pure and decent life in what we say and do. And husband and wife love and honor each other.
Yeah, so that we commit adultery. Adultery doesn't consist merely in the physical act of infidelity, but also in the content and matter and form of our speech. You know, if a husband or wife is being flirtatious with someone other than one's spouse, for example, Luther understands that to be included in this prescription against adultery. And that gets back to, you know, what you were highlighting about Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know that it's necessarily so much that Jesus is making the law stricter than what we find in the commandments. I think really he's simply revealing what God's intent in the law was from...
Yeah, that's a better way to say it. No, that's definitely a good way to point out, because I certainly didn't mean it to say as if the Ten Commandments... Well, I will say that the Ten Commandments are incomplete only in that simply because God commands doesn't mean we can fulfill them. And that's kind of the point that the Pharisees and the other religious leaders had lost when Jesus comes to the Sermon on the Mount, is they've got all the laws figured out. They keep them great. And Jesus is like, to the point where Jesus says, you know, if you want to be if you want salvation, like be perfect like the Pharisees, except Jesus has just spent all this time talking about how the Pharisees are not in any way perfect, because they hate their brother and they lust after others. And there's lots of other things that they struggle with at the heart of the matter, which is what you pointed out. And when we were talking about the first commandment last week. Didn't mean to cut you off on that, but it was certainly a better way to rephrase that.
Sure. Yeah. No. Yeah. Thank you for that. Right. That God isn't, you know, in our keeping of the law, is not looking simply for our external performance of the commandments. And you were right to bring up, you know, our discussion from last week that the first commandment isn't actually something we can do. You know, it's a command to the heart. And so what God is looking for is that we keep all of these commandments from the ground of the heart all the way up, all the way out, even into our actions. But yeah, so to go back to, you know, Jesus' treatment of this commandment against adultery in the Sermon on the Mount, as you just mentioned, you know, he says, I tell you the truth, if you even look at a woman lustfully, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. That God is looking for a whole human being, not just outwardly, but inwardly, outwardly, a whole human being existing according to the excellence for which God created us.
Yeah, yeah. And sex and marriage and the family plays an important role in that. And that's one of the weird places we've landed. We don't have to delve too far into this conversation, but the way we've landed in society where sex is everywhere, but we never talk about it in any meaningful, well, I wouldn't say that we don't, but hardly is that conversation ever public with about the real positive and negative effects of sex on a life. And we think that we, with many things in this world, we think we just kind of blow through them and they don't affect us all that much because we don't see it maybe. But anybody who's been through a family where their parents have divorced, even if it was like amicable, that affects a lot of things. And so when we treat our spouse not as an object for our gratification, but as one to be served and loved as God loves and serves us, that God is trying to protect against that. And in the time in which God is giving the commandments, the culture is not upwardly mobile for women and children. And so he's also in that sense protecting, trying to build a hedge of protection around women and children at that time as well. Yeah, I mean, I've known many people who have experienced divorce, and while they may adjust well, there's always that period of chaos and struggle and fight and questions of, well, what happens if mom and dad didn't actually, like, what the heck happened? Like, why did this happen? Is it my fault? Just all the stress that children go through, even if it has nothing to do with them at all. Just the effects that that had, that divorce and all the accompanying things that go with it. It can get chaotic and busy and very stressful.
You're right. I mean, you know, and some of those effects, while there is healing that, you know, can come to some degree, nevertheless, some of those effects are irrevocable for, you know, and last the rest of our our lives. I mean, it is, yeah, is that serious? Yeah.
So let's jump over to the seventh commandment, and if we have time, maybe we'll hit the eighth too. We'll see. There's always so much that could be said, and I always hesitate to just like information dump on everything. So the seventh commandment, nice and short, you shall not steal. What does this mean? We should fear and love God. I hope you've noticed the theme and pattern already. These explanations, we should fear and love God so that we do not take our neighbor's money or possessions or get them in any dishonest way, but help him to improve and protect his possessions and income. This one is straightforward, but sometimes I think, again, it's obvious but worth stating, God also then now seems to be caring about possessions and the things that you have, mainly because God is the one who gives us those things, as we'll see in the first article of the Creed and the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer. So yeah, that doesn't mean God calls us to abuse our wealth or to hoard stuff, but also God says, protect your neighbor's stuff from theft. Also don't steal it yourself. And we'll talk about what that looks like. It'll show up again in the ninth and 10th commandments, as well, that are worth in Luther's explanations. But yeah, we'll leave it there for that.
Going back to, again, because it's hard not to refer back to the large catechism.
It's hard.
But one of the things I'm so thankful that Luther included there, I think it's a very helpful distinction, is just because you go about gaining someone's property through legal means doesn't mean that it isn't a breaking of this commandment. If you have used the law in a dishonest way, where you're using the cover of the law, the cover of legality, to hide really the actual dishonest means, which you are using to deprive your neighbor of what is his or hers, you are breaking this commandment. That just because you got it through technically legal ways it doesn't make it right.
Yeah, well, I'll just read the little part in the ninth commandment that I was referencing before.
Sure.
Where it says, we should fear and love God so that we do not scheme to get our neighbor's inheritance or house or get it in a way which only appears right, but help and be of service to him in keeping it. So there's a lot of reflection of all of the commandments really in the ninth and tenth, and we'll talk about them in the next episode. But there, especially, every time I read the seventh, that's what always comes to mind. It's like doing it. I think here Luther is almost emphasizing the getting them in a dishonest way, where you are lying or doing whatever, maybe ruining your neighbor's reputation, shorting the market, whatever it looks like here. This one would be, massaging things, half-truths, mm-hmm. things that make yourself look good so that everybody will, yeah, he should get that because, he's not really the rightful person heir, but he is the right person or whatever. And we'll talk about that more next week, I suppose. It's a good distinction that Luther puts in there.
It seems to be maybe, directly or indirectly an address or a check on jealousy or covetousness too, where not only are we supposed to not take what is our neighbor's, mm-hmm. but if we see our neighbor in a position where he's about to wrongfully lose what mm-hmm. belongs to him, we're supposed to go out of our way to help our neighbor to protect and hold on to what belongs to him. Even if it's a car that we really like or stereo or whatever the thing is, we are not to be covetous or jealous, but if anything, zealous for helping our neighbor to retain his or her possessions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I have a note in my own small catechism here that in order to grasp kind of the scope of this commandment, we need to like expand what we mean by possessions as to more than just always the physical goods that people have, but also so not just like their stuff, but like their food, their job, the way in which they get the good things that God gives them in this world. So if somebody is wrongfully losing their job or being fired for wrong means, we should help and stand up in whatever way that looks. And again, as we pointed out before, so there's so much nuance and complication. It's never easy. And this is the messy world that we have been born into because of the fall and of sin. The flip side of this commandment is, as we talked about a little bit in the fourth commandment, is vocation. Again, God has created the world and ordered it in such a way that humans are reliant upon other humans for their daily bread. And when we get to the fourth petition, we'll see Luther includes everything and the kitchen sink under the heading of daily bread. And so in order to be daily bread for our neighbors, we need to help and protect their stuff. So not so that they will do it in return, but because they're also commanded to do the same for us. So that's the hard part I think we would struggle with all these commandments. And maybe we can kind of wrap up a little bit on this idea of this. The commandments are not a quid pro quo thing between us and our neighbor here. It's not, my parents are good, so I honor and love them. My children are good, so I honor and love them. Pick somebody you don't like. They're good enough, so I won't kill them this week. God has not given us the commandments so that our neighbors earn our keeping of them. Rather, God has given us the commandments so that we keep them for our neighbor's sake and our neighbor keeps them for our sake. And it's something that's important to remember, especially because we're not going to get to the eighth commandment today. We'll save that for next week. Something important to remember, but especially with that eighth, ninth, and tenth commandments as we delve into all of the things that God has asked us to do here. So,
it's a huge point that you bring up. Yeah, that we are to keep the commandments indiscriminately, mm-hmm. Even with respect to our enemies, that we not only try to protect the belongings of our friends and those we like and who have done right to us, but even the person who has stolen from us.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. But that they apply to the neighbor indiscriminately.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we'll just leave it at that. And there's so many things more that could be said about these commandments, but knowing especially that God has given them to us so that we can see his emphasis on what's important in this life and the way in which God has created the world to work, but also showing us that it doesn't work because instead of fearing, loving, and trusting in God, we often take the things that God has given us into our own hands for our own benefits at the disadvantage and harm of our neighbor, which is why God gives us the commandments in the first place. And that's why he gave them to the Israelites as they were getting ready to walk into a new way of living in relationship with God as their God who rescued them out of enslavement. And the question, of course, then is, well, now what? What does our life together look like now that we are not stuck trying to get to scrape by? Well, here's what it looks like. Oh, well, that's real hard. It is. But we're not stuck with the commandments, thank goodness. So with that, we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.